Hi, I'm Joe Wegman, the pharmatherapist, and I'd like to welcome you to this audio presentation entitled Psychotropic Medication Use in Pregnancy, Older Adults, and the Young. Let's start with the topic of pregnancy first and do a brief introduction. Now, physicians have been understandably reluctant to prescribe psychotropic medications to women who are either pregnant or contemplating pregnancy. For one, there's the paucity of reliable data associated with their use. For another, there are unknown risks to the fetus. Also, few women would intentionally place their unborn children at possible risk by using psychiatric medications while pregnant. However, nearly half of all pregnancies are unplanned, and significant numbers of women of childbearing age are taking medications for anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and other psychiatric conditions. This means that a considerable number of women are becoming pregnant at the same time they're being treated for a mental illness. This population must be informed to the degree possible of the risks of taking these drugs during pregnancy and nursing. Now, despite the lack of extensive data, evidence-based information studies indicate that most psychotropic drugs are relatively safe during pregnancy. Also, there's another issue to consider. Not treating pregnant women with a psychiatric diagnosis may be far riskier than the possible drawbacks and complications to the woman or child if psychotropic medications were employed during pregnancy. For example, stopping medications in a woman with a serious illness, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, could trigger a relapse that might endanger both the woman and her baby. Poor self-care, inadequate nutrition, poor prenatal and antenatal care. Still, it's normal for expectant mothers and physicians alike to be apprehensive about the use of psychiatric medications during pregnancy. The most important indicator of a healthy baby is a healthy mother. Because safety issues for both mother and child are of paramount importance, the important risk factors linked to drug use during pregnancy should be addressed. The major one is teratogenesis, or birth defects involving the malformation of the fetus or fetal organs. Teratogenesis is often a result of neural tubule defects, in which the brain and spinal cord fail to fuse together properly. Spina bifida, or cleft spine, is a common example. Two other teratogenic manifestations are facial deformity and cleft palate. Drugs that produce these malformations are known as teratogens. Now, there's also a behavioral teratogenesis. This is defined as the long-term effects on the child resulting from drug exposure in utero. Now, these effects can manifest as learning difficulties and developmental delays. Also, more information has surfaced on the subject of poor neonatal adaptation, meaning the residual effects on the newborn that can include such symptoms as hypothermia, low body temperature, difficulties in eating and sleeping, tachycardia, rapid heartbeat, and irritability. Psychotropic medication guidelines during pregnancy. Let's begin with the antidepressants. According to recent data, none of the antidepressants that have been studied in pregnancy have been found to increase the baseline rate of 1% to 3% for major malformations. Some studies, however, report an increased rate of spontaneous abortions. The SSRIs, as well as most of the cyclics, are not associated with teratogenesis. In December of 2005, however, the FDA issued a public health advisory regarding first trimester exposure to Paxil and cardiac malformations. During 2006, reports indicated that as many as 30% of children with third trimester exposure to SSRIs showed withdrawal, lack of crying, increased muscle tone, irritability, and poor sleep. The monoamine oxidase inhibitors, Remeron and Effexor, as well as Wellbutrin, have not been studied extensively. Antidepressants are present, to some extent, in breast milk. Therefore, nursing is contraindicated for women taking these drugs. Lithium is generally not recommended during pregnancy. Its use has been linked to neonatal effects, including impaired respiration and EKG, as well as heart rate abnormalities. Exposure in the first trimester is strongly associated with fetal cardiac irregularities. Lithium is also linked to Epstein's anomaly, a heart defect in which the tricuspid valve malfunctions. Lithium is highly concentrated in breast milk, Therefore, nursing is contraindicated for women taking this drug. Antipsychotics. Of all the antipsychotic medications, Haldol is the agent that has been most studied. Haldol is not linked to congenital malformations during the first trimester. Therefore, it remains the preferred antipsychotic for use during pregnancy. The newer, second-generation antipsychotics have not been studied sufficiently enough so as to determine their safety during pregnancy. All second-generation antipsychotics carry a risk for metabolic syndrome, but are associated with less risk for movement disorders compared to their first-generation counterparts. Benzodiazepines. Although there is insufficient evidence to prove that benzodiazepines are teratogens, many believe that the use of this class of drugs should be avoided during the first trimester of pregnancy due to a risk of orofacial clefts. A significant concern with benzodiazepine use during pregnancy is the emergence of neonatal central nervous system depression and withdrawal symptoms. Other symptoms of abrupt discontinuation syndrome include sedation, hypotonia, loss of muscle tonicity, apnea, reluctance to suck, and cyanosis. Benzodiazepines are secreted in breast milk and can cause sedation and slowed heart rate. Anticonvulsants. Tegretol and Depakote are established human teratogens. They should both be avoided during pregnancy. Also, both are present in breast milk. These drugs are also linked to long-term neurodevelopmental effects on offspring well into adolescence, such as EEG pattern changes, expressive language and developmental delays, and intellectual performance. Information on the newer anticonvulsants that has recently come to light is more promising. Specifically, Lamictal, Trileptal, and Neurontin, when used during pregnancy, do not increase the risk of major birth malformations. Next, I'll discuss older adults and a brief introduction. Safe medication use in an aging population requires vigilance. Patients and their caregivers must keep track of the quantity and type of medications, make sure they are taken properly and regularly, and watch for any adverse side effects and interactions. These challenges are related to the very real physiological factors that clinicians must face when prescribing and administering medications to older adults. Dosing concerns arise with the elderly. Body weights change, metabolism slows, and stomachs do not absorb substances as well as they once did. Kidneys and livers don't process fluids and toxins as efficiently. There can be as much as a 40% reduction in the clearance of certain drugs. Start low and go slow can be a helpful rule of thumb when prescribing to an aging population that is more often sensitive to the effects of medication. In postmenopausal women in particular, fatty tissue increases, which can raise the concentrations of certain drugs. Older people also tend to have proportionally less body water, so blood levels of a water-soluble drug can also be higher than would be expected. These physiological changes affect both the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics that were examined earlier on in our discussion. Also, the elderly generally take more medications and tend to self-medicate with over-the-counter drugs and herbal supplements more than younger adults. This increases the possibility of drug interactions. Some estimates place the incidence of drug interactions at 6% in patients taking two medications a day, and as high as 50% in those taking five medications a day. Okay, a little bit about what you need to know when treating older adults. Prescribers and non-prescribers will likely be seeing more elderly patients as the older of the baby boomers approach retirement. In the United States, people aged 65 and older make up just 13% of the total population, but account for 30% of all prescriptions written. Changes in mental status can be drug-related. Benzodiazepines can cause drowsiness, confusion, prolonged sedation, and memory loss. Cyclic antidepressants like Elavil can cause confusion and even delirium when used in the elderly. Benzodiazepines and cyclic antidepressants have historically been linked to falls and various types of fractures. Watch for signs of noncompliance. it sometimes takes longer to see a therapeutic effect with psychotropic medications used in seniors, placing them at risk for abruptly discontinuing their medications due to slowed response rates. Advancing age is often accompanied by less patience. Older adults should be encouraged to continue to take their medications unless otherwise instructed by their physician or other prescriber. Memory often declines with age, too. Encourage patients to keep an updated list of medications with them at all times. Provide a copy of this list to a family member. Elderly patients may be getting their prescriptions from more than one pharmacy. Encourage them to use only one source for the purchase of all medications, prescription and over-the-counter. Pharmacies now have computer software that can check for potentially problematic drug interactions. Watch for additional medications prescribed to alleviate the side effects of an already prescribed one. For example, a sleep aid may be prescribed to offset the side effects of insomnia from an antidepressant. This can set up a vicious cycle of polypharmacy, a growing and potentially serious concern in the elderly. Aging and mental health. Except for dementia, the incidence of mental illness does not increase with age. Alzheimer's disease is a common but not inevitable consequence of aging. About 50% of people over the age of 95 suffer from it. The majority of mental deterioration before age 80 is a result of the disease process, not aging. Although we all experience word-finding difficulty as we age, there is no corresponding decline in IQ scores. Successful versus unsuccessful aging can be predicted from variables assessed before the age of 50. The absence of cigarette smoking and excessive alcohol use before the age of 50 are the most important protective factors for successful aging. Exercise is another important variable. 61% of the happy well, but only 13% of the sad sick, were able to complete a 5-minute treadmill test at age 19. According to a Harvard University study. Also, in the same study, at least 16 years of education was a predictor of better aging. Now, here are some interventions to promote successful aging. Physical activity. This boosts overall physical functioning and also reduces the risk of falls. Nutrition. The single most effective intervention is caloric restriction accompanied by diets high in fiber and omega-3 fatty acids. Reduce social isolation. This lowers the risk of dementia and depression. Also, meditation has proven very useful for stress reduction in successful aging models. Okay, next we turn our discussion to children and adolescents. Here's a brief introduction. We now know that age is not a factor in psychiatric disorders. This wasn't always the case. 20 years ago, clinical communities didn't even believe mood disorders were diagnosable in children. There was a veritable absence of data supporting medication use in children. We have since learned that mood disorders such as major depression and bipolar disorder are unquestionably diagnosable in children and adolescents. As a result, psychotropic medication use by children for the treatment of mood disorders has tripled in the last 10 years. There is still, however, a paucity of reliable data addressing psychopharmacology in children and adolescents. Important points to remember with regard to child psychopharmacology include: some medications are more rapidly metabolized by children and have greater renal clearance, generally up to puberty. More rapid metabolism in children may sometimes require dosing that is equal to or even greater than doses used by adults. The variability in responses to psychotropic medication are likely due, at least in part, to neurotransmitter systems not being fully developed. In fact, according to some research reports, these systems sometimes do not fully develop until ages 21 or 22. Children and mood disorders. First, depression. According to the National Mental Health Association, 1 in 3 American children, some of preschool age, suffer from depression. Because children and adolescents tend not to spontaneously report symptoms, we often need to rely on observations from parents or primary caretakers. Signs and symptoms of pediatric depression include persistent sadness, lack of energy, motivation, or enthusiasm, changes in sleep or eating patterns, too much or too little, irritability, agitation, and unwarranted crying. In toddlers, developmental delays in language or walking, inappropriate, sad, or morbid play that concentrates on harming themselves or others, boredom and failure at school. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, approximately 1 in 20 teens has moderately severe to severe major depression, making major depression one of the most common disorders of adolescence. It occurs in both boys and girls. A substantial number have suicidal thoughts. Without effective treatment, some will eventually commit suicide. Medicating depression in children and adolescents. Cyclic antidepressants have been used for years in young people. The FDA has approved their use for children at least 12 years old. The prototype cyclic antidepressant has historically been tofranil. It has been prescribed for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, school phobia, night terrors, sleepwalking disorder, and enuresis, bedwetting. However, the cyclic antidepressants are extremely dangerous in overdose and are fraught with potentially serious side effects. For example, 6 cases of sudden death have been reported in children using norpramin due to suspected cardiac arrhythmias. The selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, are today considered first-line agents of choice for the treatment of pediatric depression. Although the clinical studies are sparse, they show that SSRIs are better tolerated and more effective than the cyclics. Since 2004, all antidepressants on the U.S. drug market have carried an FDA black box warning on the package. This label states that there is a possible risk of suicide when used by children and adolescents. We are left with a considerable amount of uncertainty regarding the use of antidepressants, especially in young people under 18. There seems to be evidence that suicidal ideation may emerge during the early phases of treatment with antidepressants. There is no evidence, though, that this increases the risk of completed suicide. No suicides in 4,000-plus children in any of these studies. Bipolar disorder. The diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children and adolescents is currently the most hotly debated issue in pediatric mental illness. Is the disorder overdiagnosed or underdiagnosed in this population group? The answer to that question is still very much up for grabs, as there are salient arguments for both positions that are dependent upon comparative studies, clinical biases, whom you ask, and personal experiences with diagnosing the disorder. There will always be young people who are diagnosed with the disorder when they shouldn't be, as well as those that are not diagnosed when they should be. Underdiagnosis is largely a byproduct of clinical ineptness that is driven by inexperience with diagnosing bipolar disorder in children and an inadequate understanding of the assessment criteria. On the other hand, overdiagnosis is fueled by the engaging storyline that bipolar disorder in children is extremely common, was previously greatly underdiagnosed, and presents differently in children because of developmental factors. This has led clinicians to ignore the DSM-IV definition of the disorder, thereby pushing the diagnostic boundaries of childhood bipolar disorder far into unfamiliar territory. The truth is that bipolar disorder is quite difficult to diagnose in children. Many of its characteristic symptoms overlap with other disorders, particularly ADHD. Irritability, agitation, and non-episodic temper outbursts are symptoms not only of ADHD, but also of oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, or anxiety disorder in children. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Child psychiatry has been on a zealous binge of creating diagnostic fads in recent years, with 3 highly visible examples to its credit. Childhood bipolar disorder, ADD, and most recently, autism. Now, thanks to a scientific review group, there's another possible contender, namely disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, DMDD, that will likely be included in DSM-5. There is no credible research on DMDD, it has been inadequately studied and is a completely untested diagnosis. A conservative prediction is that DMDD will do its part to continue fueling the fire pursuant to the already burgeoning diagnosis of mental disorders in youth, particularly bipolar. If the aforementioned scientific review group's intention is for DMDD to serve as a less risky and less stigmatizing replacement for childhood bipolar disorder, this is misguided. This is because DMDD will serve primarily as a diagnostic dumping ground for temperamental yet normal kids who are going through a developmental stage they will eventually outgrow. The last thing these children need is an ill-defined, nebulous diagnosis hanging like an albatross around their necks. Assessing and diagnosing mental health conditions in young people can be a menacing proposition. Coexisting conditions are the rule rather than the exception, and there is considerable symptom overlap among the diagnoses with childhood onset. Discriminating clinicians understand the importance of taking maturational issues into account, obtain information from collateral sources to confirm their findings, and discreetly conduct extensive interviews with the identified child and at least one parent. Now, it's true that difficult-to-manage children are the source of much consternation to parents, teachers, and even other kids. As such, overly enthusiastic clinicians often feel pressured to please worried parents by labeling and treating a child, even in instances where it is not yet possible to make a diagnosis or pursue a safe and efficacious treatment. In such instances, the mislabeled ill is accompanied by a pill, and too often nowadays, the pill is an antipsychotic with its attendant risks of weight gain and metabolic complications. Disturbingly, this psychotropic medication class has clawed its way to $15 billion in annual revenue, achieved mostly through unlabeled use. The inclusion of DMDD in DSM-5 will more than likely be fodder for even more overuse of antipsychotics in children. If it's true that pediatric bipolar disorder is wildly overdiagnosed, mounting evidence supports this premise, then the NIMH and the FDA should step up educational campaigns geared toward clinicians, parents, and teachers that focus on the difficulties inherent to diagnosing youngsters, the need for caution and the importance of employing restraint in the diagnosis, and treatment of kids with temperamental outbursts. These agencies should also launch a series of media campaigns, which clearly delineate the significant risks associated with the misuse of second-generation antipsychotics, laying the groundwork for the likely emergence of a new diagnostic fad, DMDD, as a way to curtail an old one, BPD, is futile. The childhood bipolar disorder conundrum should be faced head-on. Medicating children and adolescents with bipolar disorder. Now, the most widely used medications within the mood stabilizer category for treating pediatric bipolar disorder are lithium and Depakote. Although numerous studies confirm that these medications are effective, their safety is questionable due to the lifelong nature of bipolar disorder. Long-term lithium use has been linked to quite a few side effects, ranging from acne and cloudy thinking to weight gain, tremors, decreased thyroid function, and kidney problems. As a result, children taking lithium should have their blood levels monitored several times a year. Similarly, long-term use of Depakote can cause liver problems and toxicity. Depakote's potential health risks have led the FDA to order that a black box warning be placed on the medication for both pancreatitis and liver failure. For this reason, any child or adolescent taking Depakote should have blood work every 3 to 6 months. Second-generation antipsychotics also appear to be effective at managing the severe mood swings associated with bipolar disorder in children and teens. But again, benefit versus risk is a concern. These drugs can induce weight gain, sleepiness, Parkinson's, and extrapyramidal symptoms, elevated lipid levels, and an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. The safety-effectiveness conundrum associated with mood stabilizers and the newer antipsychotics in the treatment of pediatric bipolar disorder will most likely linger until a new, safer generation of compounds is developed. When it comes to treating children, the balance needs to favor minimizing risks. However, for children with serious and potentially dangerous behavioral problems associated with bipolar disorder, the benefits of medication use typically outweigh these risks. Anxiety disorders. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, anxiety disorders are among the most common mental, emotional, and behavioral problems to occur during childhood and adolescence. About 13 out of every 100 children and adolescents ages 9 to 17 experience some kind of anxiety disorder. Girls are affected more than boys. If left untreated, these disorders can lead to the inability to finish school, impaired social relations, low self-esteem, and eventually anxiety disorders in adulthood. Now, the onset of childhood anxiety usually begins between the ages of 6 and 8. Children at this age typically become less afraid of the dark and other imaginary dangers, and they become more afraid and anxious about performance in school and interactions with friends. Some studies suggest that anxiety disorders in children are heritable, particularly from parents that have met anxiety criteria themselves. But there's no way to prove whether the disorders are a result of biology, the environment, or both. Let's discuss a description of several anxiety types diagnosable in children and adolescents. Overanxious disorder of childhood. Now, this is similar to adult generalized anxiety disorder, GAD. Children and adolescents with this disorder engage in unrealistic and extreme worry about almost everything: their academic performance, athletic capability, even punctuality. Tense, self-conscious, and having a strong desire for reassurance, these young people may complain about aches and pains that have no physical cause. Panic disorder. In children and young teenagers, panic is rare. Rates begin to rise in older adolescents, particularly girls. As they can for adults, repeated panic attacks can be a sign of panic disorder. These attacks may be accompanied by symptoms that include a pounding heartbeat, dizziness, nausea, and feelings of imminent harm or death, accompanied by intense fear. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. Like OCD in adults, children and adolescents with OCD become trapped in patterns of repetitive thoughts and actions that are difficult to stop. These actions may include repeated hand washing, counting, hair pulling, nail biting, repetitive questioning, arranging and rearranging objects, and a strong need to control others and their environment. Children and adolescents often have much higher rates of aggressive obsessions, such as thoughts of harming themselves or others, and sexually acting out. Childhood and adolescent OCD is highly comorbid with mood, anxiety, tic, and disruptive behavior disorders. The National Institute of Mental Health suggests that nearly 10% of adult OCD sufferers have had symptoms since the ages of 5 to 10. More than 20% have had them by ages 10 to 15. And more than 40% had them by ages 15 to 20. In all, approximately 2% of the general population of children and adolescents meet OCD criteria. Separation anxiety disorder. Most often, this disorder manifests as school phobia, not wanting to attend camp or even stay at a friend's house for fear of leaving their parents. These children are frequently described as clingy. This disorder is accompanied by sadness, withdrawal, or a baseless fear of losing a family member to death or other permanent separation. Now, PTSD. There are three risk factors that have demonstrated the likelihood that children will develop post-traumatic stress disorder. Number one, the severity of the traumatic event. Number two, parental reaction to the traumatic event. And number three, physical proximity to the traumatic event. As a general rule, most studies that have examined the risk factors associated with PTSD emergence in children find that children and adolescents reporting experiences with severe trauma also report the greatest levels of PTSD-related symptoms. The extent of family support, as well as parental coping capacities, also correlate with symptom development in pediatric populations. As such, children and adolescents with a supportive family structure that includes less distress between their parents have a less acute PTSD symptom profile. Children and adolescents with a greater proximity from the traumatic event also report less distress. There are a number of factors that affect the occurrence and severity of PTSD in youth. Interpersonal traumatic events such as rape and direct physical assault are more likely to result in PTSD, as opposed to witnessing a school shooting or experiencing a natural or man-made disaster. Gender-specific studies tell us that girls are more likely than boys to develop PTSD. Finally, it is not yet clear in what way a child's age at the time of the traumatic event influences the occurrence or severity of PTSD. While some studies allude to a correlation, others simply do not. Medication management of pediatric anxiety disorders. Studies on the medication management of anxiety disorders in youth are sparse and inconclusive, and there are few specific guidelines for treating them. While benzodiazepines are used to treat anxiety and sleeplessness in children, the data supporting their use are minimal. While some anecdotal evidence has suggested possible benefit from Buspar in children, this continues to be unproven. Antihistamines such as Benadryl and Vistaril have been used for decades to ameliorate anxiety symptoms in psychiatrically disturbed children. Onafrenil and Luvox and Zoloft have FDA indications for children and adolescents with OCD. Experience with the SSRIs in controlled pediatric studies has led clinicians to consider these agents for treating non-OCD anxiety disorders as well. Controlled studies and supportive data are significantly lacking in the treatment of pediatric anxiety disorders with the beta blockers. Cognitive behavioral interventions have proven to be effective for a majority of children and adolescents with anxiety disorders. Between 50 and 80% of children respond to well-designed and effectively employed CBT treatment models, and at the completion of treatment, no longer meet diagnostic criteria for the presenting anxiety disorder. Psychotic disorders. Psychotic disorders can involve an extreme impairment in the ability to distinguish reality from fantasy, behave in an emotionally appropriate manner, and communicate effectively. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, indicates that schizophrenia is rare in children. Only about 1 in 1,000 have this disorder. Adolescent onset generally occurs between the ages of 11 and 15. Young people who do suffer from schizophrenia have psychotic periods that can involve hallucinations, social isolation, loss of contact with reality, anhedonia, an inability to experience pleasure, and delusional thoughts. The latest research indicates that for the first time, the gene implicated in schizophrenia in adults has also been linked to schizophrenia in children. In June 2007, the NIMH and the NIH convened a meeting for discussion among basic, translational, and clinical investigators to review the current knowledge on causes, neurobiology, developmental trajectory, and treatment of child and adolescent onset schizophrenia. The scientific workshop focused on three important areas: opportunities for expanding current knowledge of causes and neurobiology of child and adolescent onset schizophrenia, critical next steps to translate current understanding of behavioral cognitive characteristics, and underlying neurobiology into treatment development. Also, current challenges to conducting research in this area and strategies to overcome them. Medication management of child and adolescent psychotic disorders. The drugs of choice in the treatment of psychotic disorders in children and adolescents, regardless of the presentation, are the atypical antipsychotics. In 2007, Risperdal and Abilify gained FDA approval for the treatment of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in teens. In December 2009, the FDA approved the use of two more antipsychotic medications, Zyprexa and Seroquel, in this same age group. As previously discussed in the section on childhood bipolar disorder, benefit versus risk factors associated with the use of these drugs in youth is of considerable concern. In association with the recent approval of Zyprexa and Seroquel, the FDA stated that it wants to know more about the risk of weight gain and diabetes in young people taking these drugs and other antipsychotics as well. It has been clear for years that weight gain and other endocrine risks are associated with these medications, and their warning labels say so. Evidence now suggests, however, that these issues are even more paramount in kids. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, ADHD. Volumes have been written on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and for a time it seemed to be the diagnosis du jour for any child who couldn't sit still or pay attention in class. We now know that ADHD extends far beyond that simplistic definition, and that it can follow young people as they grow up. In fact, 50% to 75% of children with this disorder will go on to experience symptoms in adolescence and adulthood. Alarmingly, approximately half of all children with untreated ADHD go on to experience substance abuse problems in late adolescence or early adulthood. In total, ADHD affects 5 to 8% of all children in the United States. Now, the differences between ADD and ADHD can be attributed to symptom presentation. Initially, there was ADD, or mental distractibility, which many believe was a more behavioral problem than a biological one. Mental distractibility was and remains the core symptom of this disorder. But as time passed, the addition of hyperactivity to the mix prompted the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition, DSM-4-TR, to outline three subtypes of this disorder. The first subtype is the inattentive type. The child can sit still but has difficulty focusing. Then there's the hyperactive impulsive type. The child can focus but has difficulty sitting still and tends to speak and act impulsively without considering the consequences of their actions, either for themselves or others. And there's the combined type. The child has difficulty focusing and sitting still and tends to act impulsively. The core features of inattention are characterized by difficulty paying attention for sustained periods, appearing not to listen, losing needed items, being easily distracted, carelessness, forgetfulness, difficulty organizing activities, failure to follow through on tasks, and avoiding activities that require prolonged mental effort. The core features of hyperactivity impulsivity are characterized by fidgeting or squirming, leaving one's seat during class, restlessness, running and climbing excessively, talking too much, responding to questions before the question is stated, interrupting others, and experiencing difficulty waiting for one's turn. ADHD is 4 to 9 times more common in boys among children, observable in children as young as age 4, usually age 7 to 8 is onset. Often misdiagnosed due to its frequent coexistence with conditions such as bipolar disorder, anxiety, depression, mental retardation, borderline personality disorder, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, Tourette syndrome, and trauma experiences, accompanied by poor frustration tolerance, transitional difficulties, possible sleep disturbances, and poor self-image. ADHD etiology. Though initial theories focused on ADHD as a disorder of hyperarousal, an amazingly different view of the disorder has emerged from rigorous clinical investigations. The current clinical thinking is that the etiology of ADHD is not hyperarousal, but instead is primarily weakened new brain or prefrontal cortex circuitry that regulates attention and behavior. We have also learned that there is a significant genetic component associated with the disorder. As a result, norepinephrine and dopamine pathways are adversely affected. Both these neurotransmitters play a key role in the therapeutic effects of stimulant medications. Other, though unproven theories focus on vitamin deficiencies, food additives, and food allergies. Some nutritional approaches lean toward low-gluten diets and the addition of omega-3 fatty acid supplements. Also, we do know that ADHD does not develop from sugar consumption. Evaluating a child for medication. The most important telltale sign that a child may benefit from medication is when the child no longer feels accepted by peers, at school, or even at home. Social and academic impairment are important markers to take into consideration. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics requires the impairment to be observed in more than one domain, school, home, social, playground, etc., before medication treatment for ADHD is warranted. Attention deficit disorder is being overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed. Overdiagnosis is a byproduct of rising academic expectations. American children are expected to sit longer, concentrate more, and read and write earlier than ever before. Children are rushed from one activity to another. All these factors contribute to a child not focusing and paying attention. Underdiagnosis results when a youngster is labeled as a bad child, and the accompanying ADD behaviors are seen as purposeful and under the child's control. It's the unfortunate, "if only he would try harder" mantra. The most important sign that medication might be warranted is that immediate results are evident when the child begins the drug, and medication makes life less hard for ADD kids. Like them or not, 90% of children treated with psychostimulants, the pharmacological agents of choice for ADD, elicit a positive response. Medication management of ADHD. There are three classes of medications with proven effectiveness in the treatment of ADHD: psychostimulants, some antidepressants, and alpha-2 adrenergic agonists. Psychostimulants. The treatment of ADHD with psychostimulants has involved a long but steady evolutionary process over the last 5 decades. All of the psychostimulants, regardless of their onset of action or duration of action, increase prefrontal cortex levels of norepinephrine and dopamine. As such, the attentional and behavioral deficits associated with ADHD generally improve. The first stimulants employed were immediate-release preparations of Ritalin, dexedrine, and then the mixed amphetamine salt Adderall. A typical dosing regimen with these medications was to administer them 3 times daily, usually at 8 a.m., noon, and 4 p.m. The problem with the immediate-release preparations is that between doses, symptoms may return, resulting in an unstable clinical course. As such, a child's school performance would typically worsen until the next dose was administered. Also, a multiple daily dosing regimen is inconvenient, and this led to noncompliance. With the above in mind, the standard of care for treating ADHD has shifted to once daily medications. The model of the newer generation, long-acting methylphenidate drugs, is Concerta. Concerta was designed to provide 12 hours of symptom coverage, which it does by essentially replacing 3 doses of immediate-release methylphenidate administered 4 hours apart. This 12-hour symptom management recognizes the importance of covering the school day and after-school hours, including homework. After Concerta came, other methylphenidate preparations, such as Metadate CD and Ritalin LA, surfaced. These were formulated to replace 2 doses of immediate-release methylphenidate given 4 hours apart. In other words, they provide symptom coverage throughout the school day, but not after school. Also, an extended-release mixed amphetamine salt, going by the trade name Adderall XR, has become available. One of the newest psychostimulant agents, Daytrona, methylphenidate transdermal system, is a transdermal methylphenidate patch that is absorbed through the skin, thereby bypassing some metabolism through the liver. It is designed to be applied for 9 hours, works for 12 hours, and is one of the longest-acting compounds available. It also offers flexibility in that the duration of delivery can be customized. Once the patch is removed, activity still continues for another 3 hours or so. If children have a short day, they can remove the patch earlier. If they have a long day, including homework that extends into the evening hours, they can leave the patch on. First available in 2007, Vyvanse is the newest entry in the oral psychostimulant arena. It's also a long-acting agent to control ADHD symptoms throughout the day, particularly in the areas of focus, following instructions, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. It is rapidly absorbed from the gastrointestinal tract and converted to dextroamphetamine and the amino acid L-lysine, with 12-hour symptom coverage. In an open-label clinical study, Vyvanse provided overall improvement in 95% of children taking the drug for 12 months. Also, the therapeutic action of Vyvanse is not realized unless the drug is swallowed and subjected to gastrointestinal absorption. This means it may possess lower abuse potential via intranasal and intravenous routes of administration, or if smoked, when compared with other oral psychostimulants. Long-term use of psychostimulants is generally well tolerated. Common side effects include insomnia, particularly at the beginning of treatment, dry mouth, decrease in appetite and weight loss, minor changes in heart rate and blood pressure, and rebound effect in which symptoms can worsen as the medication effects wear off. Weight loss is transient. Most young subjects catch up in weight or height throughout the developmental cycle. There is some evidence that stimulants suppress the secretion of growth hormone during the years in which these medications are typically administered. Clinicians can gradually introduce dose reductions as patients get older, and at age 14 to 16, most children have a growth spike regardless of medication use. Psychostimulants are considered Schedule II controlled substances by the FDA. Next, let's discuss antidepressants. Wellbutrin and Wellbutrin SR can be helpful in treating ADHD because, like the psychostimulants, they can enhance the actions of norepinephrine and dopamine in the prefrontal cortex. SSRIs, on the other hand, due to their singular effects on serotonin, are considered poor choices in managing ADHD. From an efficacy standpoint, clinical trials indicate a clear advantage of stimulant use over Wellbutrin. However, Wellbutrin as an antidepressant can treat co-occurring depression and is not a controlled substance. Strattera is a norepinephrine-specific reuptake inhibitor, NRI, antidepressant. As such, it carries the same black box warning as do all other antidepressants for possible risk of suicide when used by children and adolescents. It was first marketed for adult ADHD before gaining FDA approval for use in children. Strattera fails miserably in head-to-head clinical trials versus the psychostimulants in managing ADHD, and long-term safety data on Strattera for use in children is not well established. Strattera has been linked to liver damage, and the drug's labeling warns that severe liver damage may progress to liver failure and the possible need for a transplant in a small percentage of patients. Alpha-2 agonists, Catapress and Tenex, are antihypertensives used to control high blood pressure. They are also used to treat some anxiety conditions and to control hyperactivity and aggression, irritability, tics, and Tourette's syndrome. They can be combined with the psychostimulants discussed above. Tenex acts directly on the prefrontal cortex to improve the so-called executive functions, including organization, planning, and foresight. In September 2009, the FDA gave its blessing to a long-acting formulation of guanfacine that goes by the brand name Intuniv, Guanfacine LA. Intuniv is approved for the treatment of ADHD in children and adolescents ages 6 to 17. Catapress was, for a time, used to treat psychostimulant-induced insomnia, but several clinical and media reports in 1995 brought attention to the death of 4 children who had been receiving methylphenidate and Catapress concomitantly. Cardiovascular toxicity was suspected. As it turned out, all of the deaths were associated with multiple variables that precluded attributing the cause of death to this drug combination. Since the mid-1990s, there have been no further reports of any serious ramifications associated with the methylphenidate-clonidine combination, likely due to its less frequent usage. Side effects of the alpha-2 agonists are mild and uncommon. They include dizziness from low blood pressure, headache, nausea, depression, and changes in heart rhythm. Drowsiness is the most common side effect. This can be addressed by first reducing the dosage, then increasing it gradually, if needed. Now a word or two about drug holidays. The issue of drug holidays, a short-term deliberate discontinuation of ADHD medication, is also known as a structured treatment interruption. These holidays can take place over a weekend, a full week, or an extended school vacation. There's no definitive conclusion as to the benefits or drawbacks to drug holidays. Some physicians maintain that because ADHD is a chronic disorder, suspending treatment is not in the patient's best interest. But for parents who are concerned about over-drugging their children, drug holidays can be a welcome relief, even if only a perceived one. According to a 2005 report in Medscape Psychiatry and Mental Health, there are three purposes to a drug holiday. Number one, to demonstrate the clinical need for medication. Number two, to temporarily remove side effects. Number three, to satisfy the notions of caregivers that medicine should not be used if it can be avoided. The most frequently cited study examined 40 children on drug holidays, and it found that weekend holidays from the psychostimulants reduced insomnia and appetite suppression without significantly increasing ADHD symptoms. The behaviors were reported by the parents. This extended to the Monday morning following the weekend, as reported by the teachers. However, anecdotal reports by some physicians indicate that patients can experience difficulty adjusting to redosing for 1 to 3 days after their drug holiday is completed. New treatment guidelines for ADD. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recently released updated ADD guidelines that recommend medication treatment for preschool children as young as age 4, despite the fact that use at such a young age remains FDA unapproved. There's an argument for and against these new guidelines. First, let's look at the for. Treating children with medication at a young age can help get a jump on a disorder that may very well progress into adolescence or into adulthood. And this guideline modification builds greater awareness about ADD, helps more kids, and increases their chances of succeeding in school. Now, a look at the against. In busy practice settings, ADD is often diagnosed cavalierly and prematurely treated with medication, especially under the relentless pressure applied by drug companies and direct advertising to parents and teachers. Thus, despite good intentions, this AAP guideline will most surely lead to a glut of medication being prescribed to children who have been inadequately assessed. Advice for parents and caretakers. Don't be too quick to conclude that a child should be treated for this disorder. Some parents, teachers, and even treating clinicians are intolerant of unruly behavior and therefore are often too quick to assign a diagnosis of ADHD. Parents should be sure that academic or social functioning is impaired and should also consider a variety of information sources to assist in diagnostic confirmation. Optimally, a child should be assessed in multiple settings, home, school, social. Extensive interviews should be conducted with the child and at least one parent. These interviews should thoroughly review the child's medical history and family history of ADHD, and reputable rating scales should be employed, particularly in instances where diagnostic uncertainty or ambiguity is in question. Most importantly, if ADHD is suspected, child should be assessed by a clinician experienced in treating pediatric disorders of childhood. A little bit about me, the author of this audio presentation. I'm a licensed clinical pharmacist and clinical social worker with more than 30 years of experience in the field of psychopharmacology. My diverse professional background in psychopharmacology and counseling affords me a unique perspective on medication management issues. In addition to consulting with numerous psychiatric facilities, I've presented psychopharmacology seminars to thousands of clinicians in 46 states. My new book, Psychopharmacology: Straight Talk on Mental Health Medications, now available in its second edition, can be obtained from Premier Publishing Media. www.pessy.com/bookstore. Again, that's www.pessy.com/bookstore and at amazon.com. Visit me online at The Pharmatherapist, www.pharmatherapist.com. That's www.pharmatherapist.com. Thank you for joining me for this audio presentation. I'm Joe Wegman.